This is a Pinball News production.
My name's Randy Perlow. I'm from Color DMD Displays. And we started the company a year ago in April that we released our first product. And this week we announced two new products, which I'll talk a little bit about. But I basically wanted to give a background and some additional information about just the process that we went through in starting the company, what a little bit more about the technology and what we do to color games, and address some of the questions that we've gotten over the past year or so. So before I start on announcements, we just released a new game on February 7th. It's Star Trek. We're showing it in the Elevation Games booth, and John has it in his booth as well. We're almost sold out of this February run. We still have a limited number available. You can either get it through our site or through our distributors. If you just go to our site and we don't have it, there's links to all the distributors that are carrying our stuff. On Monday, we announced two new products that we're previewing today, or the whole weekend. The first is Whitewater. That marks our fifth entry in multicolor displays since April. And then the other display we're showing on Twilight Zone is something that's a little bit different than what we've done before. We're calling that Sigma, and it's intended to be a single color display as opposed to the multicolor products that we've done. And I'll talk about that a little bit more at the end of the presentation. So I just wanted to give some special thanks to Mark Gardat, who's owns and operates Elevation Games and was able to get all the games for Color DMD this weekend. And also Ed Vanderveen, who's an organizer for the show and helped to set up the seminar. All right, so a little bit about Color DMD. Before it was a company, it was really just a project and a hobby-based project at that. I started back in July of 2009, and since it's evolved and we've turned into an actual business, I guess the goals of the company are really to try to enhance existing hardware platforms, adding new display capability onto legacy platforms, and then to try to do it in a way that's essentially plug and play, where you can just pull out your old display and put in something else, and it's pretty easy. You don't have to go and hack a bunch of cables together to try to make it work. A big thing that's important to us is trying to preserve the integrity of the original artwork and the original game. And so we don't do any modification of the manufacturer ROMs. We don't add in any of our own artwork. We don't modify the dots. All we're really doing is just trying to add color on top of what's already there. And there's an image of a dot matrix display, but I'm going to talk about that later, so we'll just skip past that. The premise of the company is really, you know, our marketing slogan here, that orange displays blow. Since 1991, nearly all games have used these monochrome orange displays. More recently, they've switched to LEDs, and now you get red instead of orange. And I think in the past year or so, you've seen Stern come out with a green DMD and some other manufacturers making select other colors of what's available in LEDs. When I got into pinball in a big way 6 or 7 years ago, I was kind of puzzled with why the display technology hadn't really progressed. And as I delved more into it, I found out just how challenging it is to try to incorporate a new display technology on top of these old platforms. And so I'll talk a little bit about what we went through in terms of trying to figure out how to make all this work. So here's a timeline. There's a lot of little text on there. I don't expect you to read it all. But the basic points I want to hit is, so in July 2009, that's when the idea was conceived. That's when I started keeping an engineering notebook and trying to work out how this might happen. By September 2010, I had a fully functional engineering prototype, so a little bit over a year, and then that was demonstrated at an Orange County Pinball League meeting in Southern California. And that was sort of the time that people said, hey, I think you have something here, maybe you should think about making it available to other people, which up until then, it was really, you know, I thought it was a one-off, just something cool that nobody had seen before. So in January 2011, I filed a patent on what I had, and I started shopping the idea of a product around. And then in summer of 2011, when it looked like something might happen, Chris Enright, who I'll talk about later, jumped on the project and really helped start to accelerate things. September, October of 2011, we actually brought it to some shows. And in January of 2012, formed an LLC to try to market and produce these. And finally, in April, we released the pilots, AFM displays. So a little bit over, or just under 3 years, I guess, from original idea to actual product conception and getting it out there. So color DMD represents a lot of things. So I talked about the project. We also call the display a color DMD, and the name of the company is Color DMD Displays LLC. And it's really just focused on the manufacture and marketing of the technology that I developed during the project phase. There's two members. It's myself, I'm the managing member, and then Chris Enright is there on the left. As far as what we do, from a manufacturing standpoint, we build everything ourselves, but we subcontract out a lot of the pieces. So, for example, the LCDs are the same LCDs that you get in your notebook displays. They're made by the big manufacturers like LG and AU Optronics overseas. Electronic components we get from a lot of different distributors in the U.S. For the bracket fabrication, that's the metal bracket that we mount the LCD to and put it in the game. Those are built out in Southern California. PCBs, we get the actual circuit boards fabricated overseas. They're all assembled here in the U.S. And then cable assemblies, we've done both in the U.S. and overseas. Color DMD specifically, what Chris and I do is we do all the final assembly, tests, packaging, and shipping. So basically do the design, get the pieces, put it together, and ship it out to you. And if anybody's had any technical issues, you send in an email. I'm the guy that's answering the emails and trying to help you work through it too. On distribution, we sell things ourselves. You can go to our website and basically get the full product line. We're also working with a few distribution partners. So Rick Bartlett, who's the owner-operator of Bay Area Amusements and also Planetary Pinball Supply, distributes our products in North America. Pinball Palace in the UK and Ministry of Pinball in the Netherlands. So that covers a fairly good area of pinball territory. And then we also ship worldwide. So we ship a lot to Australia. We actually still ship a lot into Europe, South America, a lot of places that I was surprised. I didn't realize how strong pinball was in those locations. So these are the products that we had up until this week. The first release was Attack from Mars, and that was in April of last year. And then it sold very quickly, much faster than I thought it would. So we re-released it again in May, and then introduced a new game, Medieval Madness, which Chris was the guy who colored that game. That was ready in August, so a few months later. Adam's Family followed a few months after that, and then Star Trek we just released last month. So we're putting out new multicolor games at about a rate of two or three, one every few months. And we're trying to look at ways to speed that up. And with Chris and I both coloring games, it's gone faster. So we actually got more games done this year than I thought we would. But we're starting to look at bringing on additional people to help with the coloring too. And I'll talk a little bit about that later. Okay, so if you haven't seen one before, this is a map. And Texas is that big thing in the middle. Where I'm from is San Clemente. It's in Southern California. It's about halfway between Los Angeles and San Diego, and that's where we're doing all this assembly and shipping from. One thing that I think is interesting that you guys probably won't, but where I'm from originally is the Northeast, and I was born and raised in New Jersey, and it sort of blows me away when people talk about small world. When Jersey Jack announced his company and his plans to build a facility, it's about 20 minutes from where I grew up. So, I moved all the way across the country, and then a pinball manufacturer shows up where I used to live. Growing up in New Jersey, we had a lot of video games. I grew up in the 70s and early 80s, and video games were everywhere. You could find them in convenience stores. You know, New Jersey has a lot of diner-type restaurants that were in the lobbies of diners. Pinballs were harder to find. Interestingly, I think our neighbor had two pinball machines in his house, which I think was pretty unusual for that period of time. So I walked in the house, I was probably 4 or 5 years old, and in his living room, he's got two pinball machines and a pachinko machine. And then I think further into the house, there was another pachinko machine. I don't know if I could even see over the top of the pinball table. I remember playing the pachinko machines, and then I remember playing outside and kicking over a can of paint on his driveway, and he yelled at me, and that was sort of the last I saw of pinball machines for a while. You know, the next time I remember seeing them is in the roller skating rink. So, you know, we'd go to the roller rinks, and that was sort of the dawn of the arcade games, and there's a lot of Asteroids and Space Invaders, and there was a few pinball machines there. I remember Black Knight laughing at me and that kind of thing. And then roller skating became uncool, and nobody did it anymore except for Shannon, who's been skating around the festival. And then I really didn't see them again after junior high until I got to college. And in college, we had a student center, and there's like this massive arcade in the student center. It was awesome. And in the back of the student center, there was a whole row of pinball machines. And that was like 86 to 90, and I remember playing Pinbot and not being very good, but you know, all of a sudden I sort of understood what I was supposed to do. There was a, you know, lock a ball, and then if you can lock two of them, something else happens. And then sort of the whole leveling thing that you had in video games started to show up in pinball. But I graduated college in 90, and looking back on it, I mentioned before the first DMD game was 91. So I completely missed the entire DMD phase of pinball. I didn't even know it existed until about 6 or 7 years ago when I started to get back into it. And the way I got into it, surprisingly, was through my job. So in 99, when the internet bubble was happening, I moved from New Jersey to Southern California to work for a semiconductor company. And they had been really successful, and there were a lot of young guys who made a whole lot of money and were buying really expensive toys. And they started to build their own home arcades. And I guess they bought enough stuff that the guy who was selling them thought, hey, this would be a great marketing idea. Let me give you one for free and put it in the office. And so all of a sudden, around 2000, I got introduced to MAME. I hadn't known anything about MAME until that point. And if you guys had ever seen these, it's kind of an awkward thing. You have to sit in a chair to sort of get it the right height to play it. And there's a PC, just a regular PC, that sits in the bottom, and you pull it out, and there's to pick the game that you wanted to play, you had to use the keyboard. But I thought this was fantastic. I had never seen anything like it, and it had over 2,000 games on it, and it was just crazy. So a few years later, when my wife and I moved to a larger house, and we sort of had a little bit of empty space, I started thinking about doing a game room. And I thought, well, it would be pretty cool if I could go buy one of those. And then I looked into it a little bit more and saw these are selling for like over $3,000, and I wasn't sure my wife was in for that. But in looking through the internet, I discovered that there's this website, arcadecontrols.com. I don't know if any of you guys have seen it, but it's a forum similar to RGP, except you have a lot of people posting projects, and they're showing all these arcade cabinets that they're building. And then I found out that the guy who runs that website actually published a book that, you know, it gives you almost step-by-step instructions for how to build your own MAME cabinet. So I said to my wife, I can do this. You know, I can build this. And she sort of looked at me sideways, and I did it anyway. So, you know, I started in the garage and just raw MDF, didn't really know what I was doing. Luckily, I didn't cut off any fingers or limbs or anything. But, you know, I assembled this whole thing and really got into the whole technical side behind it and, you know, built my own joysticks and arcade cabinet and everything. And I thought this was the coolest thing ever. And I'm thinking, I've got two young kids, and I'm going to give them their own arcade. And I've got to be the coolest dad ever, right? So we put the game room together, and I had an air hockey table that I had picked up and that they weren't that impressed with, which sort of launched into the main cabinet. And I even got a dance pad, because dance pads were cool for 5 minutes. And so I had this whole thing running, and you know, the kids weren't that excited about the air hockey table. And then when I put in the MAME cabinet, surprisingly, they weren't that excited about the MAME cabinet either. So I started thinking, what else can I put in there that would make this fun for them? And so one of the guys that I used to work with, I knew was into pinball machines. And I asked him, you know, so I'm thinking about getting a pinball machine for my little tiny game room that I can't fit much stuff in. And he sort of looked at me sideways and said, why do you want to buy a pinball machine? And I said, oh, I don't know. I think, you know, it'd just be something that would be kind of fun. And he's like, well, you know they always break, right? And I'm like, yeah, that's okay. I just went through this whole thing with the MAME cabinet, so it might be kind of fun. And I started looking into it more, and I found Rec Games Pinball, and I found Clay's Guides, and I got one game. And you could see, that's the day we brought it home. You could see how excited my kids were. It's like, wow, a pinball machine. And then that's probably the most excited they've ever been about a pinball machine. So, you know, it turned into my space, and I didn't have too many problems with that game. It was kind of new, but people started telling me, you know, you got to watch out because they multiply. And I said, no, look, my room's really small. There's no room to put anything else in it. It's fine. You know, and if you saw Jerry's talk before, I think within like 2 or 3 months, the air hockey table was on Craigslist. And, you know, we took a vacation in New Jersey, and I came back with 2 more pinball machines. And so, you know, before long, I had a row of games there that were breaking that I did have to learn more about how to fix them. And I just sort of fell in love with the hobby. I mean, especially the repair side of it. I'm an engineer. A lot of what's in the game is stuff that I learned about in school, but then you graduate and go do, you know, more modern things and sort of never get to touch electronics. So for me, it was a lot of fun, and I started to get kind of crazy into the hobby and what I would call contracting the disease. And that's around the time I got involved with the Orange County Pinball League. So there's a picture of Chris. Chris runs the Orange County Pinball League, and I think I have a whole collection of pictures of Chris riding stuff. So Chris builds his own model trains that you can actually sit on and ride, and that was a more unusual one, so I thought I'd show you that one. But, you know, Chris runs the Orange County Pinball League. Another interesting thing about Chris is he's an expert in plastic molded parts and also machine parts. And if anybody's ever seen the Twilight Zone clock tower or clock housings, or seen, you know, for the old World Series game, he did some really custom metal machining for these parts that are almost impossible to find or repair. And so he's been into pinball a lot longer than I have, and really found ways to contribute and use things that he knew. Another guy I met in the Orange County Pinball League is Bill Long. And so if you're not familiar with Bill Long, he's got a company called UFO Pinball. And if you've ever seen the Attack from Mars games, he's got these light kit that goes into the flying saucers and just sort of lights it up in random patterns. But it's really an amazing mod. I think when I was introduced to him, I was introduced as, here's the guy that's created the most amazing mod for pinball ever. And it is. It's really a cool thing, because if you look at it, it looks like it belonged in the game from the beginning. It's not over the top. It's not really about bling. And, you know, in talking to Bill about it, you know, he told me a story about when they first brought it to a show and showed it to people. They had it running all weekend. And, you know, if you look at it for a while, you sort of take it for granted. And then at the end of the show, they were taking it back out of the host game and, you know, turned the power back on and looked at it, and it was sort of, oh, you know, suddenly something was missing. And so even though it wasn't part of the game, it looked like it should have been part of the game. And, you know, and seeing what he did and being able to sort of take his talents in the electronic space and apply it to pinball and actually contribute something that people were getting a lot of enjoyment from, that was a big inspiration for me. And that's sort of what launched me in terms of thinking about what I might be able to do. So I started thinking about what other project is there that's like Bill's project. And I wasn't as smart as Bill. I really couldn't come up with anything sort of small and cool that you could knock out with a small microprocessor. But one of the other projects I found while I was looking around was this one. So Ed Chung's the guy. I don't know Ed personally, but if you go to his website, you can look at all the different things that he's done. I think he's an actual NASA engineer, like a true rocket scientist. And he went off and took this board that you can buy. I think it's a $200 board, and basically found a way to replicate the entire WPC MPU and display into a single chip. So I'll show this board a little bit more in a minute. But there's a small chip in the middle of it. That's where all the work is being done. It basically took these two big boards that you have in your games and collapsed them. And the concern was that, hey, these games are breaking, and WPC security chips aren't really around anymore. And so here's a way that we could keep games alive, even if the parts aren't really there anymore. Another thing that he did that I'm not showing is he had a companion board that would plug in and do all the audio stuff. So for me, you know, this is just crazy smart stuff and really cool. But one thing that I think got stuck in my head, even though this wasn't my original plan, is if you look, he's got this board, and there's a VGA cable sticking out the back of the board, and it's running up to a standard computer display. And so his emulation of the WPC game is there running on the LCD display. And so, to my knowledge, that's the first time anybody did anything like that. In truth, when I started the project, I had no intentions of using an LCD. I was looking at the LED dot matrix modules that people are using now to build displays. But I wanted color, so I needed RGB. And they didn't really come in the right form factor. And I think for a small 8x8 display, if you went to SparkFun's website, you're looking at something that's like $30 for one very small module that wasn't the right size anyway. And that almost killed the idea. And I think maybe this being stuck in my head got me thinking, well, maybe I can use an LCD to try to accomplish something similar. So if you have a chance, I would go check out his site. He's got some pretty cool stuff. But here's my idea of the perfect project. This is what I was trying to figure out what I could do that I just couldn't figure it out. So if any of you guys have seen for the new Tron game from Stern, there's a couple guys, Eli and Jeremy, I think, were the guys that did most of the work. But they found a way to rip out the Stern cabinet that comes with it. They built their own custom cabinet. They put a small, tiny, I think it's either a small LCD or a small OLED display in it that, you know, you could, similar displays to what they put on cameras and cell phones and that kind of stuff. And to me, this is like the Belong project again, right? Because you put this in your game, and it's basically using that MAME that I talked about before to run through the attract mode for Tron. And you've actually got this little video game playing within your pinball machine. It's really cool. But for me, this is, again, it's that mod that really isn't a mod. It doesn't look like a mod. It looks like Stern should have put it there if they could, you know, if they could have dealt with the cost or the licensing or whatever else it would have taken. The reason to me that this is perfect, though, beyond that, is it's a really well-defined goal, right? You sort of get in and out. You know what you're going to build. You get it working. You do all the design once, and then you just sort of produce as many as people want. That's what I was aiming for. Somehow I got sidetracked into something that's way bigger than what I had originally intended. So I'm going to bring you, I'll try to do this quickly, but take you through the steps that I went through in trying to get from a prototype to something that we could actually sell. So just real quickly, this is the standard dot matrix display. Hopefully everybody in the room is pretty familiar with it by now. They're high voltage gas plasma displays, and people talk about how many levels or shades they have. There's no inherent shading within a dot matrix display. There's no levels. Everything's what they call pulse width modulated or duty cycle modulated. You just turn a light on and off. And depending on what the ratio is of on to off, that sort of sets how bright it seems to you. And it's a scanning display similar to a TV, so they'll light one row at a time. So even though it looks like it's on all the time, it's not. There's only one row that's ever lit at a time. But it's going fast enough that your eye sort of averages it out, and it looks like a solid display. Everything that we've done so far, we've done with Bally Williams games. There's a small difference in the way Bally Williams sent signaling to the display that's different than Stern. And that's the reason why we haven't really delved too deeply into Stern yet. That's one reason. Another reason is that the mounting and the powering is a little bit different than what we'd have to do for WPC. So we've exploited you know, the same WPC platform across a lot of games, but supporting Stern is something that we plan on doing in the not-too-distant future. If you look at how the display is generated, just real quickly, most of the WPC games are four different levels. I don't know how easy it is to see in the picture, but the display basically is generated by the CPU as a two-bit image. There's a high-bit image and a low-bit image, and these are sent by the processor. You can see it off on the left side of the picture, up through those big ribbon cables to the WPC video controller board up in the right corner. And there's a video RAM there where pictures are sent as fast as the processor can make it. They'll send pairs of pictures out to the video RAM. And then the way the video card works is it just starts streaming stuff to the display. And it'll keep streaming the same picture over and over again until it gets something new from the processor that says, okay, now switch to this picture. And they're basically sent in triplets. So to get four levels, if they want a bright bit, they light the same dot in three images in a row. If they want it slightly dimmer, then they'll light it in two out of the three images, which would be the high page. If they want it less bright, they'll light it in one page, in the low page, and only send it once out of the three. And then obviously not sending it all, it would be dark. And that's how they generate four levels. So when I started building this and I wanted to figure out how do we put color into this system, there's kind of two places that you could do it, right? One is to go in and try to do it at the processor level, which I think is what most people thought you would have to do at the time. And then the other way, which is the way we ultimately did it, is snoop what's going to the DMD and try to do something intelligent there to map color on top of what they're sending. And the benefit of that, obviously, is it's a lot easier because you don't have to reverse engineer these ROMs. But it's also a little bit harder in the sense that the game doesn't always cooperate with what you're trying to do. So the first step before I actually delved too deeply into the hardware was I wanted to get an idea, is this even worth it? You know, what would the game look like if it was colored? And so I came up with a simple Windows paint program where I could take some captured .dot files and bring them in. And it's probably hard to see here, but there's some colors there that on the right-hand side of the image. And to paint it, you don't really have to color every single dot one at a time. You could sort of just drag a rectangle over part of the image. And, you know, there's a green rectangle in this section that's hard to see that covers the alien and also covers the black space. And you don't have to be that accurate with how you paint it because the dots are taking care of it for you. So if you look at what some of the guys are doing with the LED displays and they're putting colored filters on, it's a similar idea where our paint window is trying to make a colored filter that sits in front of the backlight. That's kind of the idea. So when the dots are coming in, to us, they're just gray levels. They're just white level intensities. And then we're trying to make the LCD put this color filter in front of what the game is trying to do. So one of the comments when we first announced it is, oh, it's like a Nintendo, Game Boy, color Game Boy, where they're just mapping the four different colors, the four different gray levels to four different colors. And that's not what we were doing. We were actually trying to do this filtering so that we wouldn't lose any of the gray leveling that the artist had originally put there. And quite frankly, I did experiment a little bit with just color mapping from gray to a color, and it looked horrible. So when I created a patent, this is sort of what it looked like for what I had built. So the DMD signal comes in on the left, and the basic idea is that you try to recognize what frame the game's sending. You do some processing, which in this case is adding color to it. Then we have to come up with a new video interface to interface to whatever display device we're trying to talk to, which in our case is an LCD display. And then it comes out on the right side. So some of the ideas here is that you want to come up with something that's more of an engine rather than individually coding every game, because if you coded one game, then when you move to the second game, it's not portable in any way. So instead, we basically built this color processing engine that can move from any game, and you just have to change the input files that you're feeding it. So this is sort of the evolution. So there's that board that I showed you before. It's the same board that Ed Chung had. And this was the first ever testing of a color DMD. And you can see the image there was just pure animation. It was, I think one of the ramp shots or a loop shot. And what I did was came up with a small, simple engine that sat in that FPGA in the center of that board that was able to recognize each individual frame and throw color up on top of it in real time. And you could sit in front of the game and actually flip the game. And if it wasn't something that it recognized, it would just show up as white. And when it would hit something that it recognized, you'd get the full color image. And I propped it up on a 15-inch monitor that was sort of around the same size, just to put it up in front of the speaker panel to get a feeling for what it might look like. The next step was I ripped the display out of the monitor and then tried to just adhesively stick the boards to the back of it, and you can see that there. And then we were able to mount it inside the game. And I think that's when Chris first started helping me. He came up with a custom mounting that let us put that in the game. And you could see also by September, this is when we had the fully working thing, it's not just doing straight animations, but there's scoring there and some other random effects, which are more difficult to deal with, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. Okay, here's a close-up of it. So this is with the speaker panel folded down. You could see Chris's brackets on the left and right there. This is this 3D printed, very custom thing that would never be workable from a manufacturing standpoint, but got the prototype working. The FPGA board that's doing all the processing is on the left. The board on the right is basically the power supply from the monitor. And if you look at in the center, I'm taking the high voltage DMD power cable and basically running it into this power supply board to generate the lower voltage signals that the color DMD controller would need. But also, it's generating this super high voltage signal that lights up a CCFL, which is cold cathode fluorescent inverter. So the old LCD displays were all really high voltage, like a fluorescent light. And so, I'm lucky. I think it's low current, but I think I'm lucky that I never sort of hurt myself playing with this. But it was clearly something that wasn't producible in any way, but allowed us to just sort of see what it might look like. I got lucky at the time that manufacturers were starting to come out with this LED backlight, which is a low voltage backlight. And I think without that step, I probably wouldn't have never taken the chance of trying to give you guys something like this where you might get hurt. But that was some of the challenges. The form factor, it's not reproducible. The mounting bracket was tough. That monitor was in like heavy steel. It was really heavy. And there was always a concern that we're going to snap the standoffs on the speaker panel and people are going to be screaming at us. And then the high voltage stuff. And then it's expensive. That board, for the prototyping purposes, is like a $200 board, I think. So, there was a lot of work still to be done, and that's sort of when I reached a decision point about, is this a one-off, or are we going to try to do something with it? And so that was the time that I made a video, and I started sending it around to some people, and Rick at Bay Area was one of the guys. I sent it around to some higher-end collectors, too, because I figured if anybody's going to be crazy enough to spend money on it, it'll be them. Just show of hands, have you guys all seen the AFM video that we did? Because I won't waste time showing it if you've seen it. Okay, so we'll skip through that. But what it led to is we got a lot of positive feedback that said, yeah, I think you should try to make a run at it. So, the next 6 months, there was a whole lot of work reworking the entire system to try to make it something that could potentially make it to your house. And so I designed a small custom circuit board for the controller, which was actually a first for me. I hadn't done that before. And so that was really cool because I got to learn a lot. And the panel we replaced with a lightweight LED-based backlight, high-definition panel, where the entire system could be run off at 12 volts, which to me made it like, okay, I'm not going to get sued for somebody electrocuting themselves, so we can move forward. And then Chris, who's the mechanical engineer, was trying to figure out a real bracket solution that we could use here. And then all the time, I'm still trying to work on the engine and clean up some things that were lacking. And so that was the production prototype that we showed at PPE and Expo in September of 2011. You could see it It looks a little different than what we're selling today, if you own one. But we originally had cut out the metal bracket because we were trying to make it lightweight. And then what we didn't realize is that when you light up the LCD, the backlight just comes shining out the back of it. And so it lights up the whole back box, and that wasn't a great idea. So in the future, we changed that. Also, the board is a larger board than what we ultimately used. And in the bottom there, you could see the LCD. So it's a standard notebook size LCD, and we're just lighting up the center of it, the part that fits within the window of the speaker panel. And so that was another issue, too, is like, is this really going to work? Is it going to block the translight? And we sort of got lucky because everything just sort of fit and worked really well on the WPC platforms. So that was September, October. Between then and April, we actually went through two more board spins. So one was, I had originally planned to have USB support on there, so we could use that to load game firmware, and then if, you know, for all the things that we messed up, you guys would be able to reflash your board and fix it. And then, you know, we also found out, so that was sort of one spin. And then the second spin was while we were doing AFM, or while I was working on AFM, Chris was working on Medieval, and all of a sudden he ran out of memory. And of course, the memory that I picked didn't fit in this. You couldn't increase the size in the same package. So we had to do another board spin right before we released AFM so that we would have some memory for growth. But this kind of message that, like, we don't know what we don't know for the future is one of the things that we're still hanging on to and not overselling what we have or making promises that we're not sure we'll be able to deliver on later. So this was good in a lot of ways, and sort of we ended up with this at the end. And so there's the LCD mounted in the bracket. And in the upper right, you can see it mounted to the speaker panel. And then in the lower right, you could see it. That's without the translight in. You could see the frame of the LCD just comes over the lip of the WPC95 panel. And that's basically what we went to market with. If you look at a close-up of the board, so there's a picture again of what the idea was, right, what the processing is. And so the way it works is the DMD signal comes in through that black connector in the upper left, flows into the chip in the middle, and then basically flows out into the 40-pin cable with the gold connector just below it. That's the data flow path. And then I think on the next picture. Oh, okay, before I get to that. So I told you about the surprise we had with the memory. So when we moved from Medieval to Atoms, we ran into another surprise that we didn't expect, which was that there was a light board mounted underneath the speaker panel or underneath the DMD. And we actually took it. We had some work done on it, and we brought it over, and we're like, okay, let's install it and see how it looks. And all of a sudden, we're like, oh, what do we do now? So we had to come up with a solution for that, and the solution for that was to add this lamp interface, this 9-pin connector lamp interface, and there's two white chips there. Those are optocouplers. So those actually replaced the light bulbs that are in the thing light board. And so what we're detecting is when the diodes inside those optocouplers light up, we detect that, and then we use that to light up a square on the screen. So we actually put our screen where the lamp board goes, and we're using the screen to light up the thing inserts, which seemed to have worked out okay. But there again, so here's the board, and you can see the data flow path again. It's from the upper left through the big chip down through the connector in the middle. The lower left of the board below the white optocouplers is just the switching power supply. So that's the low voltage supply. We're coming in with 5 and 12 volts from the game. We're really only using the 12. We switch that down to the voltages that we need to drive the panel as well as to drive the chips on board. To the right-hand side, you can see there's a chip directly to the right of the FPGA. That's the USB host controller. And so that's what enables us for you to put a USB stick in and update your game or update your board to do a better job with your current game. In the lower right corner, there's another small chip. That's the memory that's getting updated. And then we put a simple four-button interface up on the right-hand side. And if you have one of these, you know, you can go into a menu system and change. Right now, what you're able to change is you can go from your game-specific color DMD, you could switch it into a single-color mode. and basically take that color DMD, put it in any WPC, WPC 95 game in a single color. Okay, so that's sort of what we went through to get to a product. Just real quickly, because people ask about how games are coded and things. I don't want to get too technical. I'll try to keep it pretty high level. But that FPGA processor that's in the middle, that stands for Field Programmable Gate Array. Basically, it's a programmable IC. It's not a microprocessor. So what's inside that chip are custom circuits that are implemented through these logic tables. And by coming up with using a high-level language, you can configure these logic tables to really make complex circuits, including things like putting small embedded microprocessors within the fabric of the FPGA, but also doing all the high-speed interfacing that we need to make everything work. And so that's how the engine's implemented. It's really a combination of custom hardware and a little bit of software. So when people ask, where's the code, and why won't you make it open source, and you know we want to look at it and play with it, the code's really sort of obscure. It's in RTL language, which defines these custom circuits. The micro that's in there is really primitive, and it needs to be coded in assembly language. The USB host processor does have some C code associated with it, but it's really pretty simple, just reading stuff off the thumb drive. So the message here is that the code that we have is what we need to implement this custom engine. There is no game-specific code at all. And so games are colored. They're not coded. And I'll try to explain a little bit about what that means. So if we want to color a game, basically we have software that emulates what the hardware engine is going to do. And so by manipulating the data that we feed to the hardware engine, we can get different effects on the display. So it all starts with trying to get a library of images out of the game. And this is really a tedious process. You have to play the game over and over and over again. And people ask, well, why don't you just dump the ROMs? Well, there's some really smart people who found ways to disassemble the ROMs. And what you'll find in there are pieces of graphics. You know, you'll get a graphic image, or maybe, you know, if something's moving across the screen, you have a cannonball in Medieval that shoots across the screen. There's a picture of the cannonball here, and then there's a picture of the castle somewhere else. And it's not all composited together. And so for us, if we need to identify the frame, those pieces are not very useful. So the only way for us to do it is to understand and build a library of what happens when all these things are put together. And so this process is playing over and over again, manually switching triggers, or triggering switches, rather, in the proper sequence to get the game to show all the animation that's there. The next step is for that library of captured frames, we want to try to generate a unique ID for each frame. And then we paint all the frames and try to save a table of the IDs and the color information to ROM. So we don't save the actual dot intensities. We're just saving the color data that goes on top of it. And it all starts as a really simple idea until you start trying to do it and you find out all the things that could go wrong. So the first thing that you hit right away is that most of the images in a pinball machine, you have some graphics and then you've got the player score. And the player score can be anything. So there's really no way to say, okay, well, I've got the whole frame captured. I know what all the dot intensities are. So I'll just save that frame. And then when the engine sees that frame, when it sees all the same dot intensities, I'll just add color to it. That doesn't work. So the first thing we had to do is come up with algorithms for how do we separate the stuff that is unique from the stuff that isn't unique. And so masks work for this, and I don't know if you can see it, but basically there's a mask from the right side of the image over that's ignoring everything that's over there, which includes the score. And you know, we could just use this section of the image with the aliens running to try to identify which animation frame is being sent. And so when the game plays back, when we detect the aliens running, we know, okay, well, we want the aliens over here to be green and they have red eyes, and then this text up here, we're just going to put a blue rectangle over that, and the score over there, we'll put a white rectangle over that. And then as the game's playing and the score's changing, it's just shining through this color filter, and so the engine does the work for you. And that process probably covers about 90%. So the reason why we don't just open everything up is that last 10% can be a killer. And so that last 10% is what keeps me busy trying to support Chris when he's coloring games with finding issues with the engine and things that don't work. And that, you know, if you try to brute force it, you know, you might spend a lifetime trying to capture all possible combinations of what the game can put out. So some of these things that come up are like looper ramp counters that count forever. You know, so in those cases, it might not be possible if you have text on top of a graphic, you can't just plop a white rectangle over it. You have to actually color the right part of the screen where the number is. But if you have counters that count forever, you can't capture every possible, well, maybe you can, but it would take a really long time. Another issue that we run into is screen scrolling and fade. So, you know, there's a lot of animations where it'll show a player score and then it'll slide off the screen and then there'll be a new animation behind it. Since you can't see everything at once, you only see a few rows, it's hard to know what's coming next. So those are hard things to deal with. And then things like moving backgrounds, like the stars in Star Trek, or objects that can appear in a large number of combinations, like in Adam's Family, when Cousin It's walking and he's throwing objects over his shoulder, there's like 10 different things that he can throw each time. So you've got 100 combinations. Makes it really difficult to just capture everything. So, you know, we had to come up with new things. Sometimes we do brute force it. Sometimes we come up with some kind of ingenious things. And then sometimes I just have to make changes to the coloring engine. And so that's the support side that really takes a lot of time. And that's why we haven't opened things up so far. The killer challenge that we had of all challenges is the video modes. So on the first game that we did, Attack from Mars has a pretty simple video mode where you have a tank at the bottom and his gun is scrolling back and forth. The tank doesn't move. And the spaceships only come down from the top. And they actually follow a pattern. They just go in a straight line from the top to the bottom. So on that one, you know, we were sort of able to do something simple. Like, you know, if you can recognize that there's a tank at the bottom, or that there's a solid stripe of ground there, then you could use the same engine that we had before and just sort of divide the screen up. So anything above the tank is green. You know, the tank itself was like a yellowish green, which might be hard to see in the picture. And then below the tank, it's red. And it wasn't really what I wanted, but it's what I had, and it kind of worked. And, you know, that's what we've sold for Attack from Mars. When we got to Medieval, Chris said, oh, the video mode in Medieval is really hard. And I said, what video mode? You know, I didn't even know there was one. It's really hard to get to, apparently. But there's a video mode with the farmer, and he's got a pitchfork, and there's babies crawling around, and there's birds flying in, and the birds are trying to pick up the babies and carry them away. And everything's just moving everywhere, just like a video game would. And, you know, there was no way that we could take what we had at that point and make it work. And so starting with Medieval, I had to come up with something new, totally new, which we call a sprite coloring engine. So if you have any experience with computer graphics, sprites are these little objects that they sort of get painted and moved around the screen. What we had to do was come up with something that could locate and track all these objects as they're moving around and try to add color to them in real time as they're invading each other's space. So I have a short demo of this. What I want you to focus on is just as things are moving, you know, notice how the different objects are all sort of overlapping. And the challenge here is trying to paint things so that you're kind of, even when something's obscured, you're still able to recognize it. And then when you paint it, you're not painting over things that shouldn't be that color. So here's a real short demo. So coming up with this in my head, it was really simple. And then when we got to implementation, making it work nearly killed me. But once we got this working, we were able to leverage that into a lot of other things that we were doing. So for Adam's Family, you know, I mentioned Cousin It. Now if he's throwing a hairbrush over his shoulder, if we can recognize the hairbrush, we only have to custom color the hairbrush. So we don't have to try to brute force recognize everything. When we did Star Trek, I think there's like 6 different instances where this feature got implemented. That only one of which was an actual video mode. All the rest just made the job of coloring easier because you had all these different combinations that could come up at the same time. Okay, so that's sort of the technology behind it. As far as what's new, so we're showing previews this week of two new, well, it seems like two new games, but it's really one new game, Whitewater, and then a new product that's aimed at something completely different. So Let's just talk about Whitewater first. So this is our fifth multicolor game release. It's using the same hardware as the previous platform. I don't think we had to do much invention for Whitewater. So that's a good sign, because it means maybe we're getting to the point where the engine's stable, and we might be able to start leveraging other people to help with this. I wanted to show you guys some before and after shots, which hopefully you can see. It might be a little bit dim. But just kind of point things out that we didn't see right away and might be interesting. So on this one, if I just move forward, this is the No Way Out screen where the raft is heading towards a skull tunnel. So one thing I wanted to point out here is if you look at the rafters, first of all, there's two guys in the boat, which I didn't really notice before, but we'll talk more about that in a minute. But if you look at his arm and his body for the back rafter, they're the same color. And so, looking at any still frame, when you only have four gray levels or four orange levels, it's sometimes really hard to see what's going on in there. And since we're stepping through it frame by frame, we can sort of see the sequence of what the artist was trying to do. And by just adding a little bit of color, even though it's a pretty low resolution image, you can make things pop out that maybe you didn't see before. So that's one example of that. Here's the hot foot sequence. So we love the fire stuff. Anything that's exploding or fire, it looks really good in multicolor. And you just don't get the same effect. And if you get to this one on the game and you have a chance to look up, what's happening is his arm's slowly moving out, and then all of a sudden when he gets to his foot, the whole foot just bursts into flames, and there's like this charcoal foot left behind. It's a pretty cool sequence.
Actually, when I just saw it, it started out white. Was it supposed to be that? It started out white, or grayish, and then went into the color.
No, it shouldn't have done that. If it's doing it, I'll have to look at what's going on. This one's just a fun one. There's all these pictures of Bigfoot that, he's doing weird things like picking his nose. But back to the point of like things being hard to see. What I want to do on the next three, I like to call this Where's Waldo? So these are pictures that I had no idea what was in there until we sort of stepped through it, and I think make a really big impact when you're watching the game. So I'm going to show you something for just a second or two, and then I'm going to take it off, and you guys tell me what you saw. Anybody know what they saw? Okay. So if you look, it's actually a hill, and then in the lower left corner of that, there's two guys coming down in a boat. And so if you follow this animation all the way through, this raft comes down, hits the rocks, the two guys go flying out of the boat, spin in a cartwheel, land in the water splashes, and it's kind of cool. But when you watch it on the game, you can't see any of it, because most of the time when they're spinning, it's all in front of the rocks. And they're all, the same four levels. And there's not enough contrast to really see what's going on. And so if you go back over into the game hall and you're watching this, watch these sequences with the raft, because it really makes a huge impact. I've owned this game for years and had no idea that what was happening. I never knew that the guys fell out of the raft. It was pretty cool when I figured it out. Here's another one. You guys see anything? So it's a whirlpool. You see the guys sinking in the whirlpool? So that's actually a sequence where the raft comes in and it starts spinning around, and it's hard to tell the raft from a wave. I didn't know what was there. But the two guys actually spin around until they get sucked down the whirlpool. Here's one more. This is the last one. Do you see the guys in that one? So they actually come all the way around. And so it's really simple stuff, but when you look at it on the display, the guy's head there is like four dots, right? It's not high res. It's not Attack from Mars. It's not Medieval. It's not Star Trek. But just small, simple changes can make a big difference if you're watching the screen. And so that's the point of that. And not all the games have the same high resolution graphics, but even when we do a lower resolution one like Atoms or Whitewater, I think there's still a big pop value if you look at it. I'm pretty pleased with how it came out. All right, so the last thing I want to talk about is the Sigma display. So Sigma is really, it's running on the same hardware as the Color DMD. There were some guys in the news group who, they talk about a couple things. One thing is on the LED displays, people don't always like how the grid lines line up. And we didn't really have that problem, but it sort of prompted the idea, like, what if there were no grid lines? What if we could leverage that LCD? You know, we're spending a lot of money on that LCD panel and only making dots out of it. So what if we could do more? You know, another thing that happened on the news groups is that somebody posted, hey, I'd really like to see Twilight Zone in black and white. And we were kind of scratching our head, like, black and white, that's, what's that? That's not going to be anything. And somebody did it. They moved their color DMD and filmed it for the guy and posted it. And all of a sudden, there's like 10 more responses like, that looks awesome. And for us, Twilight Zone's a really difficult game to do because you've got all this random stuff going on that I talked about. And so that was always left for, this will be like the last thing we do after we solve all the other problems. Then we'll get to Twilight Zone. But since there was such interest, we said, okay, well, you know, maybe we can do a little bit more with it. And we had this scalable thing going on anyway. And, you know, a few weeks ago, Chris had an idea, well, what if we not only scaled it, but added scan lines to it and tried to make it look like a, kind of like the old TV. And so that's what we're showing in the hall today. But what the panel really is it's a... It's aimed at the single color market. We took out of that chip all the color processing. The chip was pretty full. We were using all the available resources. But we put in this upscaling capability. And so that display can do dots. It can do HD upscaling, or it can do the scanline effect. And it still preserves the ability to switch between the 49 different colors that we have. It's basically 48 different color hues plus white is where the 49 came from. And so we plan to make this available. We might make it available if you have a color DMD and you want to play with this. You know, I think we'll likely just make it available. You could flash from USB to add these features and see if you like it. But the other goal is to try to make it available for games that we haven't multicolored, where as an alternative to just using a blue LED display or an orange plasma display, you know, you could make Monster Bash for the time being. You can make it purple if you want, or you can make your creature from the Black Lagoon green. So it's really whatever you want to do. So it's user customizable. You know, I've been trying to gauge the reaction to the upscaling. I think some people really like it, some people aren't sure. But the idea is that you pick. You know, we'll make the options available to you, and you can make it dots if you want, or you can make it upscale. Right now it'll work with any WPC or WPC95 game. And as I mentioned before, if there's interest, we're going to start working on trying to make this work within other manufacturers' games. So just a real quick comparison. I posted this to the news group a week ago, and we actually improved the upscaling a little bit the last minute right before the show to try to clean up some of the text a little bit. But so up at the top's the classic dots, and then you could see the effect of the upscaling, where we're trying to fill in the space between the dots but still preserve the shape of the text. So that's harder than it sounds, because if you look at scores like, you know, the number 7, it's a steep slope. It steps up 2 dots, over a dot, up 2 dots, over a dot. And if we just sort of connected it together with squares, it would look pretty bad. So then the next thing we did was, well, what if we just connect the dots, and where it steps up by 1, maybe it just sort of cuts over and joins them on a diagonal, and then you get zigzags. So what's in there now, if you look at it, you get a real smooth line, upscaled to 14 by 14. Each dot's represented as a 14 by 14 pixel square on the screen, to try to get all those diagonal lines as clean as we can. And then you can see the scan lines there on the bottom. And then here's another one. This is with a different game. This is Monster Bash. It's sort of maybe hard to see, but just the same 3 pictures there. So, you know, thank you for coming. Thanks for supporting us. You know, the amount of interest in what we're doing has been overwhelming at times, and we really appreciate it. If you haven't been to the booth yet, please visit the Elevation Games booth. He's got a whole lineup of all the games that Color DMD has done so far. There's the 4 games that are available now. We're almost sold out through the website. But if you go to our distributor site, I think some of the other games are still available. And then the 2 new ones we're planning to release either late April or early May. And if you're not on our mailing list, please join our mailing list and sign up for whatever products you think you might buy in the future, because that helps us plan allocations when we build displays, you know, making sure we have the right number of each game for you guys. So that's what I have, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You mentioned you re-released Attack from Mars. Does that mean that you release them in limited quantities, and then once you're sold out, you stop and you have to make another run, or are always, always available?
So the first game that we did, I think we built 100, or maybe just slightly over 100. It was a pilot release, and to be honest, I thought we might sell like 20, and then I'd be holding on to 80 for a really long time, begging people to take them. And I was surprised it sold in like 7 hours. So we sold the first 100 in 7 hours. I had some blank boards, so we went back and got the parts and built up the rest of the blank boards. And so we were able to turn around another release pretty quickly, and we did like another 100, and that sold in 7 hours too. So from there, we just started increasing. And so the next run, we did Medieval and kind of doubled the number that we were doing, and then set some aside for Attack and some for Medieval. And that's when I got into trouble. You know, people got really upset because I said, okay, they're available. But I had already pre-sold a lot to distributors, and so when they went to order them from our site, I think Medieval was gone in like 15 minutes. And Attack from Mars went for like a week. I think we had them for a week, and then they were gone. So we're building a bunch, and we've increased our volumes since then. So the last run that we did in February is just about sold out now, and then you know we're gearing up for the next run. So it's easier for us. Neither Chris or I is doing this as our full-time deal. This is, you know, we have regular day jobs, and this is nights and weekends, and so it's better if we can sort of bunch everything up and get a few people to help us put it together. And then we'll sell it out and then plan for the next one.
But you continue to replenish them as they go out.
Yeah.
The reason I ask is because some of these games I don't have, but I intend on having later, so I didn't know if I need to stock up on some of these.
So I think this is where the mailing list is important, because if we know that there's a lot of interest, you don't have to buy it from us. You know, you don't have to buy it at all. But if we know that there's interest, then you know, we can plan to have more of that game available than another game.
A technical question, just an idea for you. The technical question is, you have the ability to set the backlight level. Is there any dimming that comes over time that you're aware of with the backlight LEDs?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing that I think is really interesting, maybe you can tell it at some point or 20 years from now, is the sort of build a business up story here, you know. Enough money to build 100 and sell them.
Yeah.
Keep going forward. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. So, the question was like telling the story about building the business and how we do it. So, it's interesting now looking at what some of the other pinball companies have done and the fact that there's this whole Kickstarter phenomenon. You know, I was fortunate, and since we were starting with a small run, it was self-financed. So I took a chance. You know, I felt it was an acceptable risk. And so we just sort of did it ourselves. On following runs, people are asking, oh, can I pre-order? Will you take my money now so that I can make sure that I get it? And I've tried to avoid that altogether. You know, I don't want to take anybody's anything until I have something in return. So, you know, I think that was partly people were getting upset because we wouldn't take pre-orders and then they were selling out kind of quickly. And so, you know, why won't you take a pre-order? Why do I have to be sitting by the computer when, as soon as it becomes available? And so the way we've solved that problem is just we've been able to leverage over time the success of the prior runs and just invest a little bit more and do a larger run. So that seemed to have worked out pretty well. Both of the last two runs, we've had stock for about a month from the time that we first released them. So, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. You know, I don't completely understand the business model that's happening in other parts of pinball, but I guess there's different ways of accomplishing it.
So, the two questions I had were, how are you picking your games to color? And the second question is, are you concerned about end-of-line type of scenarios where Xilinx stops providing FPGAs that meet your needs, or the display technology that you're using goes end of life, that kind of thing. How are you, I guess, protecting your future given current technology changes?
Yeah. So the technology does turn over pretty quickly. And, you know, if you look at the Xilinx part that we're using, that's a 65 nanometer process. They've been in their 40 nanometer process for a couple of years now. And so it's always true that things phase out. And, you know, my intention at this point is, as long as the business survives, we'll just keep evolving with the technology and providing new boards that will work with the new displays. For the legacy stuff, we're trying to use standard computer parts that won't be around forever for the LCDs, but they're produced in mass quantities. They're not custom to us. And so, you know, if your LCD goes bad, you can go on eBay today and get a, you know, a laptop monitor for a Dell PC and swap it out yourself. So there's some longevity there as long as those kinds of replacement parts continue to exist. But there's already new LCD technology that's being introduced. It's at a higher price point at the moment. When we launched, we went with the best display we could find. And we actually, our displays are high definition displays, and that wasn't because we needed resolution, that was because the field of view on the lower resolution displays was just terrible. And you know, some people still look at ours and say, well, it's still not as good as the LED, but that was the best that you could get at the time. And so what we're seeing now is manufacturers are starting to come out with even better displays that, in the small scale display that that we'll want to leverage in the future. So I think we'll continue to upgrade with the technology as it goes. As far as picking games, so when I first had the idea, the first game that I thought I was going to do was Medieval Madness. And I think the trolls were the first animation that I ever played with. And that was the decision factor. Once I saw the trolls colored, I was like, this is really cool. You know, we have to do something like this. And I started doing the joust scene with Medieval. And, you know, after a couple weeks, I realized I don't own a Medieval. Why am I focusing so much on Medieval? But I did have an Attack from Mars, and that's another game that had great graphics, and so I just cut over to Attack from Mars. When Chris got involved, he had a Medieval. And so it was like, okay, let's do Medieval. So there wasn't a lot of science to it, and it wasn't a business at that point. It was really just sort of what we had and what we thought would be fun and cool. I think when we picked Atoms, that was, you know, the first thought of like, okay, this is really a business. Let's try something where there's a higher volume of games out there and see what happens. And, you know, I think our experience so far has been that the production volumes don't really matter that much. It's the number of collectors that are out there. Because it seems like the numbers that we sell for the high volume games is similar to the numbers that we sell for the low volume games. So, our intent is to try to cover, you know, all the top Bally Williams games. And so we're not that careful about picking which one's next. It's just sort of, you know, sometimes we pick one because we think it's easier and we need a break because we just finished one that was really challenging. So, you know, for me, Whitewater was one that I said, the next game I do is Whitewater because I thought it would be easy. And, you know, I got it about halfway done and then we got the idea to try to do this single color upscale display. And I said, Chris, you have to finish this because I have to focus on more development stuff. So there's not really a science to it, but you know, I think in the end, all the games that people are asking for the most will get done. And then I think the more obscure games, hopefully by then the tools will be robust enough that it doesn't require a lot of support from us. And you know, we'll be able to share the tools with other people.
Well, I may have missed this, but I know in the previous, you know, when I first saw your video and what you were coming out, said the board is bound to the game. Now, it's what you're talking about, like 1.3 and the USB flash. Do I still have to buy the board for the game, or are you going to provide the different game files? Because if I have it in my Adams family, and then I go sell or do something different, and I want to keep the board, and I would put it in my Star Trek, it would be nice just to flash it and say, okay, now it's going to run my Star Trek, or are you just going to be in charge for that, or are you just going to make those files available? I mean,
So that's a question that we've wrestled with. What do we do for people who, they buy it from one game, and then they want to sell the game but keep the display? And it's a tough question. That there's technical reasons why we didn't want to ever promise that you'll be able to change. If I sell you an Attack from Mars now, you can use it with an Adams Family later, because you saw that we had to change the board. You know, I had to change it once when we went to Medieval, and then I had to change it again when we went to Adams Family. And I didn't know what other issues we'd run into. So that was the technical reason. And then there's the business reason, too, is that, you know, if we sell 100 boards and basically we go off and do more development, invest time in developing these libraries for other games, but it's really just the same 100 people converting their board over to whatever the latest thing was, then it kills the incentive to continue to develop and create, and also kills the goal that, you know, my hope was that we'd really get color into as many games as possible. So what we started with is that, you know, we're making it for one game, we're only marketing and selling it for one game, and we added this other feature where you could turn it into a single color display. And if you want to move it, if you want to keep the display and you want to move it to another game, you have that option. You know, it's not as good as being able to reflash it to whatever your new game is, but, you know, it was a feature that we could add and maybe somebody would get some use out of it. And that's still the model that we're under, but it's getting harder for us as we have to support more games and keep inventory on more games. You know, it's difficult. And I think the goal for us at some point would be to just sell one display and let you guys convert it to whatever you want.
I mean, yeah, and a price model would be like, you sell the game, that's like buying an iPad, and then I download the app.
Right.
So I download, I pay a charge
right.
for the hardware, and then I pay a charge for the software
right.
for this game. Because I may get it for my Adams, and I may not sell my Adams, but I'm like, no, I really want to see what it looks like on my Star Trek,
right.
and I want to be able to put it in there
right.
and see it. Because the end result for maybe for a lot of people here is they look both in opposite order separate because they look both good in both.
Right.
But, you know, obviously here and seeing it, you know, it's different. But for other people, when I try to explain this to some of my friends, like, well, I don't really get it. I see the video, but I don't, you know, and I said,
yeah.
you just got to really see it. Well, I want to see it from my specific
right.
game. And it makes it look more different.
Yeah. I mean, we toyed around with, you know, maybe we can enable it for, you know, you can play it for so long before it reverts back so you can sort of get a demo or whatever. But,
oh, that's a good idea.
But you know, I think what you're talking about is something that we discussed in some of the interviews that we did, where it shifts from a hardware-based business model where we're at now to sort of a software-based model, which requires a different amount of infrastructure and support. So when somebody wants to flash their game and they can't figure out how to do it, and they, you know, they start sending emails like it didn't work and I have to get on the phone with them, it's just a whole nother level of support.
Sure.
That I think we're headed in that direction. I just don't know when we're gonna cut over to that.
Plus you have to protect your intellectual rights and make sure that your files aren't floating freely across
yeah.
the internet to just be downloaded.
Right. So if anybody's tried to flash a board, there's a product key that goes. It's unique to every board, and then also unique to every game. And so that's another factor, is that if you want to, even if you call me and you said, hey, I'm willing to pay to switch my game over, I have to generate a new product key for that configuration. We don't have like automated software that you can just go online and do it yourself. You know, if we had that today, I think maybe we could offer that as a service. But like I said, I'm well aware that that's what our customers are looking for, is that ability to move. And I think it's just trying to figure out when the right time to do that is and how we support it.
Well, you know, I mean, for me, really the issue is it's a price point. You know, I'm not saying it's a significant investment personally. You know, if I buy Pinball Pro speakers or whatever and I spend $100-some bucks for some speakers,
right.
I may let it go, but I'm spending $400. It's a bigger point. If I'm selling a machine for $2,000, I don't want $400 to go with it.
Right.
You know, so, well, not these games, but I'm just using that as an example. If you add more games, and I go, it makes it a cost justification.
Right. So I think our hope, and I don't know if it works out, maybe you guys can feed us some information, but the hope was that if you sell the game, if the display holds its value, then we'd much rather have you sell it with the game and then, you know, create an opportunity for another display and then have more displays out in the field. So far what we've seen, you know, when people take one of the displays and put it up for sale. It seems like they are holding their value so far. So I think that's another reason too that we haven't been prompted to rush into this, you know, where it's, you know, there's a whole lot of people moving games around and then they're stuck with $400 displays that don't do a whole lot. But, you know, just one other point, I guess, on the value proposition is I totally agree. It's an expensive display. It's an expensive investment. You know, it's driven by our cost. It's what it takes for us to do it. You know, comparing it against the LED displays that are available now, and Stern just had an announcement this week that they were going to start offering blue DMDs at a $399 retail price point. Our hope is that we're still providing value by being able to change the color, you know, even if you're using it in a single color mode, being able to change the color, being able to pick, you know, if you want the upscaling, if you like the way that looks.
Quick question, because maybe I missed it. On that single color mode, how do I change the color?
So there's...
There's the one out there in the Twilight Zone, right? And it had the single and the white or whatever it was.
So on all the displays, there's the four buttons that I pointed out at the top. So it's sort of like the old Bally Williams menu system. You know, if you click on the right button, you start stepping through the menus, and there's different options that you can pick from for color or for display mode.
So, like, if I bought this for my Star Trek, I can first put it in my Twilight Zone just to see what it looks like in different colors.
Right.
Without any involvement or...
Right. Any other questions?
Just a general question. You see the technical part, you were saying for every frame you have to interpret. I know there's a part about the score and you can kind of... I'm just curious, just typical, how many frames did you have to interpret for like Medieval Madness?
I think Medieval Madness, I think we counted, there was like 2,000 unique frames. Now, that includes the high page and the low page. So I think, you know, as a composite, it's maybe 1,000 unique. But the paint program has some features where if you color something and it scrolls up, you know, we can take that previous frame and scroll it up. So it's less than that how many you actually have to, you know, do from scratch. So there's some things that help. But I think the estimate that we have is it's generally about 100 hours to color the game.
Coming in April, support that you would have on that, is that going to be on the 1.3 board?
Yeah, so the next run will be the same hardware platform that we've used since Adam's family.
I know you said you're not doing Stern yet, but I think Tron would look really cool with multiple colors.
Yeah, so some of the Sterns are hard because a lot of it's captured film, and there's not those clear outlines to try to color. You know, if it's an animated thing and it's outlined and it's, you know, okay, the whole face, this whole area here is just a you know, flesh colored rectangle, it's pretty straightforward. So the Stern stuff is daunting, but we'll see what we can do with it. Okay, thanks. Oh, another question.
What about JD East or other platforms?
So we'll start with Stern. I think from the board standpoint, the processing that we need to add to do Stern, I think, will apply to all the other manufacturers. I think the real challenge for moving it between games is coming up with a mounting solution and a powering solution that works and is simple for you to do. So we haven't really delved into that. You know, it's just everything's a matter of time, and we've just been consumed with the things that we put out so far.
I think it's awesome.
Yeah, thanks.
Phenomenal. All right. Well, I appreciate everybody coming out, and you know, thanks for the interest.